Mary Alice, I want to warmly welcome you to the Conscious Evolution Summit.
Oh, thank you very much. Really glad to be here.
And I also want to welcome you, our audience, from wherever you are watching or listening to this interview. So I hope it inspires you, it touches you, and it lands in you and inspires what I call love in action. So, Mary Alice, we met already a few years ago in, it was called the Learning Village in Slovenia. Mm-hmm. And since then, I follow a bit your activities, and I felt that what you do and the experience you have in working with groups, with governments, might be of benefit for this summit, because especially what you share with your storytelling. And I just want to invite you to share a bit what are you doing with groups, and how did it come that you found, I would say, your purpose right now to do this storytelling?
How long have we got? Well, I'm Mary Alice. I call myself a story activist. And by that, activist for me is, how do you activate the stories you really want to live in and live up to, I suppose? So how do we activate the stories we most want to live in? And I think right now is a really good time to think about this, because there are a lot of ways that story is working in the world. And one of those is, it seems to be a way we want to try to put influence over somebody else or control each other. And it's a time to be very awake and aware. So one quote I like very much is, the business of stories is not entertainment. It's about being awake. The business of stories is being awake. And I came to the work I'm doing in story and with groups, kind of these are two different threads, but they both started in New Zealand, interestingly enough. I'm not from New Zealand, but I went to New Zealand when I was 25 and lived there for almost 30 years. And so I sometimes say I had my formative time in New Zealand. And when I was about 35, I went to the first International Storytelling Festival there. I hadn't ever heard of that before, but I went. It was held in a boys' school. And so if you can imagine adults sitting on small chairs at desks listening to storytellers, that's kind of what it was about. But there was one salient moment for me, and it was listening to a storyteller called Jay O'Callaghan. He's a well-known teller in the States. He's been in Time magazine. He's done stories for NASA and things like that. But he is what I would call the soul of graciousness, a really beautiful man. And he was telling a story called Penelope with the 1,000 Rainbows in Her Pocket. And it was a serial story inside of a story, which came to a really beautiful ending. And everybody in the room was transported by this story and quite emotionally impacted. Even the men who were kind of trying to look like, please don't notice that I'm finding this very emotional. But in that moment when it happened, I had this thought, wow, what happened here? And then a split second later, the thought, I wonder if I could do that. I wonder if I could tell a story that would move people like that. And so I did the only thing I knew how to do, which was go to the local library and hang out in the 398.2 shelf, which is the story of folktales, myths, legends, and fairy tales, and to begin to feed myself stories. So I grew up as the child of an English teacher and a guidance counselor, and so two teachers. But we didn't tell a lot of stories in our family. We read a lot. So this was really my first experience of how powerful hearing somebody tell a story is. And of course, if you're human, it's the most powerful thing anybody can do for or with you is to tell you a story. We are set up, the neural network is set up to actually resonate to stories and to hold all of our experiences in story form. So that was the first time I saw it. And then eventually in my career life, I became a facilitator, somebody who works with groups. And I was kind of like, when are these two things going to weave together. So I began to see at the same time in my working life the power a good process has of helping people meet each other and come into conversation that can move things further. And you might say that conversation is the medium for transformation, or you could say story is the medium for transformation. They're kind of in the same family, that if anything's going to change, first an idea, then a conversation, and then change, if we're going to be in it together. And sometimes it's even true in yourself. First, you have to have a new conversation with yourself, and then change can happen. So eventually, it was about 2003 when the story and organizational movement started happening that I could see these two threads weaving together. In 2007, I ran into Art of Hosting, working on a project called The 4 Million Dreams. So after 9/11, when that happened, I was in New Zealand about to host a conference when the towers fell. And I considered my response to that event. And I said, as a facilitator, you know, for my working life, the question is, how do we help people come together with those people who are most different to them and actually be in conversation? How do I meet people? And I called a group together and said, will you help me dream about the future of this country? How could New Zealand offer its gifts to the world? And that became the 4 Million Dreams Project. And we realized that transformational conversation was necessary. And that's when I found out about Art of Hosting, which is an international group that teaches participatory practice so that people can host and harvest conversations that truly matter. And then these two things started weaving together. I brought story into Art of Hosting, hosting into my story work, and that's how it's kind of unfolded.
Thank you very much. And I think about what, because you used the word of transformation. And in your opinion, which ingredients are necessary that a story has the potential to transform?
I often talk about the difference between big S stories and little S stories. So story with a big S, you know, story with a big S might be the Twin Towers, or I survived the airplane crash, or there was an earthquake, and then. And I listen to stories of disaster, and often they start with, it was a beautiful day, ... So a lot of people think that you have to have a big S story in order to transform something. But I think small S stories, the stories we carry as individuals, the moment you learned how to not fall into judgment and listen to the other person instead, or how you battled with your depression, or how you learned to connect with somebody really different to you. These kind of anecdotal small S stories can also be lifesavers for people. So what makes a transformational story may be different to anybody in any circumstance, but it's what speaks to you at that moment that can give you a different perspective. It opens the door. There's somebody who likes to say your story could be the key to someone else's prison. And the interesting thing about the way stories work, what I think is so wonderful about them, is that they kind of go here and here at the same time. They have a way of bypassing the thinking mind and going right to the heart, because they are given in a way that kind of really fits in with the way that the mind is patterned. So we love listening to stories. We are really adept at filling in the blanks. I often test this with people. I say, so here's my story. Last week in Denmark, I was riding my bicycle, and I go on for a little bit. And then I turn to them and say, what color is my bicycle? And then I point to a few people and they all tell me different colors. That's because their mind has filled in the blank. Very few of them get that I actually own a gold bicycle. I do. Still lives in Denmark. But it's really interesting to me to see how their brain fills in the blanks. So our brain naturally does that. And we naturally kind of put ourselves, if we're interested enough, into the shoes of the protagonist. So hearing a story that resonates with us is like going into a cupboard and trying on somebody else's coat.
Yeah, this immediately came also to my mind, or I sensed it, that when a story really touches me, it becomes my reality. In this moment, it feels I live it. I'm in the movie. I'm in the story. It's not separate.
Yeah, yeah. And brain researchers have actually shown that. So when they link up the person who's telling the story and the person who's listening, my brain, if I'm listening to your story, my brain will begin firing in the same pattern as your brain. So actually, from a neurochemical point of view, I am in the story with you. I can feel those things, which is why a compelling story is in fact quite compelling. And as human beings, we need emotion in order to take action. So until the emotion is there, so this is an interesting question. Why haven't we taken action on climate change? I listened to Naomi Klein, who is of course a climate activist, talking about, these pictures of polar bears with diminishing ice flows don't do anything for me. She said, but when I began listening to stories of people who were working on this issue, the stories started to get me. So that kind of polar bear image, which we see a lot and is meant to trigger emotion, may not to some people, but the challenge for climate change is often the story sounds so big and so huge that I personally can't see what to do. I was at the COP15 in 2009 working with a group of young people in the Klimaforum, they called it there. And I heard this one teenager say, I know I should take a shorter shower, but nobody I know is doing that, so it's hard for me to keep it up. There wasn't a compelling enough story within her age group to have her go, oh, I can see how that can work for me, let me do that too. So we really resonate with stories and we get compelled by them, especially when we kind of get entrained. There's an entrainment that happens. Entrainment, that word really means like we get on the train and we're on the journey with somebody. And it really happens here in the brain. And the reason that stories are so powerful is because they help the brain to put out dopamine and oxytocin. So oxytocin is the chemical that has us go, oh, community, a belonging. It's a sense of belonging, community. We love sitting in oxytocin. And dopamine, of course, makes us feel good. So you could ask, why do people like listening to scary stories? Because in the end, they feel good. Ooh, that wasn't me. Okay, I feel okay. So there's a lot of reasons why stories really resonate with us as a human being. But for me right at the moment, there's a real question about how do we become awake to what they're doing? I have a colleague in Washington, D.C. who says the most important real estate on the planet is this space in between your ears. And you need to be the guardian of that boundary and say, what stories am I allowing to live in my head rent free? And stories are everywhere. So we're getting them not only through the media, through all of our magazines, through our literature, through our culture. We are steeped in stories, like almost like a tea bag in hot water, of the things we believe to be true. So if you have someone say to you, that's the way it is, then often it's because they believe the prevailing or dominant cultural storyline that things have always been this way and they will always continue to be this way. So I often say, this is my most interesting phrase, that's the way it is. I'd say, well, really? Because how it is a product of the choices we've made and the stories we've told to each other up until now. And it's as simple as change the story, change the world. That's simple, but it's not easy because there's a lot tied to our stories. Because, well, if you look at me, I'm a story field. We're all story fields. We're not a single story. We're the intersection of all the stories we hold about ourselves and all the stories others hold about us and all of the things we're co-opted by. So I happen to have been born with an American accent. I've spent most of my life, more than half my lifetime, living outside of the U.S. But still, when I open my mouth, I am co-opted by the story of who somebody thinks I am. So I spent 35 years in New Zealand being asked almost daily, where are you from? I called that my graciousness question, because when I was feeling gracious, I could realize this is a connector question. It's trying to figure out who are you and how do I fit with you? This is a question that's asked by the British culture, the prevailing culture in New Zealand, as a way of, you know, who are you? And it's also asked by the Maori culture as a way of, how do I link to you? So this is a very common question. But when I perceived that that question was coming with a judgment, oh, you're this, and I've stereotyped you. So I don't think that we stereotype, I think we stereotype. I've stereotyped you. I love that word. Here's the box I think you're in, and just would you prove to me that I'm right? Then I would get like really, you know, that would really raise my hackles, because I could feel the judgment in it. I'm being stereotyped by a story that is inherent in the cultural background I grew up in and in the accent I'm carrying, but you have no idea what I've done since then. So you can see the covers of the book, but you can't see any of the contents, and yet you think you know what you saw. And that's easy for us to do, because the brain is a first fit pattern mechanism. It's not a best fit. And that's come from years and years of evolution. If it's big and yellow and roaring, oh my goodness, I'm not going to try to decide if it's a lion, a tiger, a cheetah, or anything else. I'm just going to run the other direction. And that's how we kind of tend to make sense of the world, by trying to do the first fit pattern so that we can see if we're safe or not. And that's back here in the reptilian brain. So the awakeness to stories needs to be here in the frontal, lobes, and in the thinking brain, not the reacting brain.
And what does support to activate that area?
Becoming awake. So a facilitator or somebody who works in group process would call this patterning the space. But let me give you an example of that. If you want to buy a car, then you might be looking at a particular car that you're interested in, and suddenly you begin to see all of these cars on the road that you never saw before. You go, wow, where did they all come from? Because they weren't there yesterday. Only because your perception wasn't looking out for them. It's the same with, you want a haircut, you want some new clothing, you want shoes. You begin to notice those things you're most interested in. And so we talked before this interview about appreciative inquiry practitioners, but people who work with appreciative inquiry are patterning the space for people to look for a new possibility by becoming awake to something that they could be interested in. And they say the question makes the roadway you go on. So same here. If I suddenly am interested in stories, stories are everywhere. They exist at the cafe. They're on the street. They're coming out of the radio. They're in the way I look at something like a tree. I have a concept or a story around what I think a tree is from my perspective. And somebody else's perspective might be quite different than that. But if I can become awake to those things, then suddenly I'm going to notice more stories, and I'm going to be able to differentiate what is a story, what's somebody's opinion, how is a story being used. So I've also realized in working with stories that, in fact, there are no innocent stories. Every story wants something. It might be, please listen to me. Please understand me. Please, can you help me think through this? This is my worldview. Every story wants something. So there aren't any innocent stories. So the question is, can I figure out what the intention of this story is in order to say, do I want it to come in here or not? Or how do I want it to come in here, rather than just kind of soaking something in blandly because I am not thinking about it or aware of it. So how do you wake up?
Yeah, and this applies for me also very much for our internal stories. Mm-hmm. What we tell ourselves on and on and on and on.
Yeah, kind of the unending record player. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and to become really awake and conscious of about what am I telling myself all the time, to what do I listening, and can I change it and shift it so that how I feel or how I act has a different flavor.
Yeah. And so the first way you can start to become aware of that is to notice when you get triggered. So when you get upset by something, most likely there is a storyline attached to it that is hitting on something. So So this, whatever this event has been, is hitting on your storyline of, or, and your storyline is what creates your worldview. So it's kind of, and these things are underneath the surface. They're in the unconscious or subconscious level. So you have to look for clues. I call that rabbit hunting. They're like, oh, the rabbit's gone down the hole. Where'd it go? So the more awake you can become to your reactions about things, the more you can question, where did that come from? What is the story I'm carrying about this? And an interesting place to look for that is if you're in a group meeting or in a group conversation, to notice how different people have different takes on what's happening. They're all creating a different story about what's happening, even though you're all part of the same space-time event. And that's because we're all unique in the story field we're carrying.
I heard one time someone sharing, it was also, I guess, a facilitator, said, we are all living in so different realities, in so different universes, and it always surprises me that in a way, we understand more or less each other. That's a surprise.
Yeah. Well, a perfect example of that, I was working on a merger process in New Zealand years ago with two different senior teams. And in as part of this process, you know, first of all, these teams had to stand together for a moment, and then eventually it was sorted out how they were going to become this new team, and not all of them were in the new configuration. But while they came together the first time, we hit a point where we suddenly realized, wow, they're using the same term for something, but they mean two different things. So they got into conflict because, and then their ways of working were quite different. One of the teams was very much into, let's communicate our issues and let's be in the issue until we work it out. And the other one is, let's confront each other with our issue and see who's still standing at the end of the conversation. And we'll know something. And these two ways of working were diametrically opposed. And they had to do with the storylines of the two different organizations of who they thought they were, what they thought they were providing, and how they thought they were doing it. And so part of the work on this merger process was to realign the stories into a new entity. And that's what a lot of merger processes don't do. They just shove two things together with the idea of, okay, well, that was then. You know, so too bad about the logo or the founding story or who you think you are. Let's go forward like this, which is why there's a lot of drag and a lot of attrition and a lot of challenge and pain in those kind of processes, because no one's attending to the story. I was just talking recently with someone about systems change. And she was talking about, first of all, the myth gap. You know, we have this misalignment of stories. And also the fact of, we don't attend to the storyline, that most people think first we do the real work and then we tell the story about it. When she said, no, actually, story is the soil out of which we do the real work. And if we don't attend to it like that, then we can get a mess. We can get soil that doesn't work, or things don't grow like they should, or, you know, if you keep going on that metaphor.
And in my experience, what I also would say is that the quality of our listening and of our capacity to accept that someone can have about something a very different story is for me a very important piece also.
Yeah. I think we have two things happening. We have both a challenge in listening, and we have question illiteracy. So one thing that I've learned over time watching stories is, whoever has the greater emotional capacity, they should be listening first. Because if someone is really churned up about something, they don't have capacity to listen. So when people get into arguments with each other, it's often somebody has gone past their capacity to even register what the other person is saying. And then there comes the shouting match of, you're not listening to me. Well, often, no, they can't. They cannot until they get listened to first.
That's a good point. I mean, that's very simple, but it's really a good point to start with that.
And strengthening your listening. I mean, the story and listening are like a yin-yang. You can't have one without the other. I mean, even if you're reading a book, then you're hoping that the person who's reading is is the story listener. So stories do not exist in a vacuum. And as a listener, in fact, you are very, very powerful to a storyteller, because anybody who's told a lot of stories, and I have, knows that you might think you're telling the same story, but how your listeners react, the what they're embodying shifts the story when you're telling it. So the more you can, I guess, be inside of yourself like a grandchild that loves its grandparents. You know, we know what that looks like. It looks like this. You don't have to look like that on the outside. But if you can be like that on the inside, wow, I'm about to be given the gift of somebody's story. I'm just so curious what it's about. It's about. Curiosity is, in fact, your biggest gift for somebody else. I really want to know who you are. Or as Charles Eisenstein likes to say, what is it like to be you? Mm. That's the biggest gift you can give someone, is to honor their story. And I've had people tell me the most painful thing they've ever experienced is to tell their story and have someone to say, have someone else say, that's not how it was, or that's not true.
Mm, yeah. Oh my God, that's a killer.
Oh, that's so awful. But listening, and particularly I would call it deep listening, a deeply resonant, emotionally supportive, I'm here for you and present to you, rather than falling into my own mind and going off in my own story, is one of the biggest gifts you can give people. And then by the power of your questions, you can open the doorway to different understanding or to different stories. So what I personally love and kind of go, ooh, one tick, is when somebody says, that's not the story I expected to tell. That means my listening has been good enough that they've gone into what actually needed to be shared right in the moment, not what they thought they'd prepared in their mind. So Listening is an incredible skill. It's a humanity skill, and it's also a leadership skill. We have focused an awful lot on the answers, but we haven't focused a lot on what are the powerful questions. And often our questions are too small. They'd be what I call the what's for dinner question. A lot of what's for dinner question is, how does that work? How much does it cost? Who's done that before? These are things that tend to shrink the conversation, rather than what's the most powerful positive intention that this work could have? Who do we truly want to be as we're out there doing our work? If our story were to unfold in a surprisingly amazing way, what would that sound like? So questions, and when I'm working with groups, I usually start with questions. To start with a question is a really powerful door opener. And a question can keep engaging. And then tell stories to that question. What are the stories around that? What can we learn from those stories? What can we see or possibilities? Or maybe we're even telling a future story. It could be like this. And then what are the conversations that come out of those potent stories? What are the compelling conversations we then need to have to shift something? And out of that conversation, what's the new sense and meaning making that we can do collectively together to then take us to higher ground, to take us to either deeper purpose, stronger vision, or our learning edge? What's the next learning edge that takes us into the next question, the next set of stories, and so on?
Mm, yeah. Beautiful. And what also came now to my mind is that the quality of our emotion we have when we tell a story is also so impactful, because I can tell a story where I'm, let's say there is a certain fact and I tell it neutral. And then the second time I go in an emotion of, let's say, maybe fear or not accepting, telling the same facts, they sound very different. Or I go in a emotion of compassion, of connectedness, the same facts, it sounds very different.
Yeah. So the big question, what is your intention in telling this story? Yeah. What is your, if you were thinking about, okay, I need to tell a story in this coming thing, then the first thing, what's my intention for telling this? Why do I want to share this particular thing? And what message do I want to leave with the person who's there with me? And maybe it's not, maybe it's even in the moment. So that's an interesting question too. Still, what is my intention of telling this was a good start? And then that's called, what you've just described is called LOTS, language of the senses. And the more of that you can provide, the more the other person can see what you see in your mind. So I talked before about my bicycle, my golden bicycle, which most people, when they listen to me, go, it's red. I don't know if they think I'm a red personality or what, you know, it's going to be bright red or bright blue or something. But if I want somebody to know that, I need to say it. Otherwise, they will fill in the blanks. And the classic fairy tale structures tells you that. Once upon a time, there was a king. So now in your mind is some picture of a king. If I want you to know more about him, I have to describe him, or I have to give you some language of the senses or some emotion in order to feel what he's feeling or to see what it's like. So the more I describe something, the more you can see what I'm seeing, and the more my emotion is there with it, the more I allow the authenticity. So when people talk about authenticity, someone asked me what's the most important thing about good storytelling, and I actually said, be authentic. It's not a, what people want more than anything, if you're not a performer, is not a performance. They want you, you. How do you feel about it? What happened to you? If that hurt, let me know. If it made you really happy, let me know. If whatever that is, take me there with you, because then it's more authentic for me. I feel you as a person, and then I can trust you more, and then I can understand you more, and I can be with you more. And probably that gives you greater latitude to tell me something that's different to my worldview. And I might go, okay, I can get that from your perspective, because I can feel you. So I cannot see you the same anymore. I can't make you a them. You know, this us and them. You can only do that when you've never heard somebody's story. Mm-hmm. Once you have, you can't them them anymore, because you know too much. You know, they've become a human. They become a three-dimensional person. So, I mean, the interesting thing for me on the idea of conscious evolution is that, of course, from a consciousness point of view, who we are as humans is far beyond the story. But it's the construct we have for understanding the world. So understanding it is the way to find the way through it to who we are truly meant to be.
Yeah, and in that way, I also... what I really love also to go to this edge where we don't know. Yeah. And there it starts becoming really interesting.
Yeah, the not knowing.
Yeah.
And it's we're in an interesting point right now as humanity, because we're kind of running out the end of our old narratives. Our old kind of dominator narrative is not working. It's killing the planet. And it's like falling through the net. Nothing is catching us anymore. We don't know who we are. I think it's particularly hard when you look at gender roles. What are women? What are men? And now, of course, we're in that point where we need to talk about, and what's between this binary construct? Because it's not either or anymore. I came back to the U.S. and for the first time got into an introduction round in a group where they said, please introduce yourself and say what your personal pronouns are. I was like, what? Hello, my name is Mary Alice, and my personal pronouns are she and her. But I was in a circle with a man who said his personal pronouns were they or them. He didn't want to be restricted to this single role that he thought he'd been given as his prevailing body story. And it's a very interesting thing to reformat your brain and say, well, maybe there's more than this or that. Maybe there's a range of and that's quite interesting. And so how are our stories portraying that? And I began after that moment to look around and go, wow, we have a lot of binary stories going on. And we have a lot of old constructs which are not fitting people anymore. We're then kind of struggling against them. I'm not a that. I want to be, or I don't want to be labeled.
That's so, it just popped up also. What I really love when I wake up in the morning and I wake up in this curiosity and then in this open space with this attitude, let's see who I will be today.
Lovely.
To have this openness that I'm allow myself to be surprised by myself, you know, that's so, that feels alive, that feels real, that feels also very natural in a way. And there it starts, you know, when you start the day with this attitude, that it's a little thing, but it changes a lot.
Yeah. It's that curiosity. Who am I being today, and how might that manifest? And for some people, that's easier when they're in natural surroundings. I think much more difficult when you're in a very busy city life or somewhere where there are lots of distractions. So how do we cultivate that space inside of ourselves, the spaciousness to allow our story to change, to not be stuck in it? First of all, to become aware of it, and then to say, where are the stuck bits of it that I want to shift? How do I entertain that it might be different? How do I get myself some good listening so I can actually hear my own story? Yeah. Work I do often with people is invite them to do a fairy tale, but a fairy tale that's in the third person. So an interesting part of my own storyline, when I was born, since my surname is Arthur, my parents put out a birth announcement that the Princess Royal was expected in King Arthur's court, you know, Camelot. So I'm actually a princess. My parents said so. But my challenge in my whole life has been nobody else knew I was a princess. And actually, I've realized after traveling so much, I might be the princess in the pea, you know, that one that goes, what's wrong with this bed? So it's interesting to say, once upon a time, a princess was born. This is how my fairy tale started out. Two seemingly ordinary looking parents. Mm-hmm. That was the first line of my story. And then I went on to describe what happened and the attributes I'd been given, and then, and so what, and so what. And then often in this fairy tale, I ask people, I use sentence stems. So once upon a time there was, he or she was given, or however you describe yourself with your personal pronoun, was given the gifts of this. And the challenges he, she, they met were these. Eventually they found themselves at the crossroads called something. And there met a figure, or met whatever it is, who said to them, this must be picked up and this must be put down in order for you to move forward, and handed them a parchment which said. So that's a kind of typical fairy tale construct, that you meet somebody at the crossroads, and that the crossroads is a time or a place of transformation, and that there's a time when you need to put something down. Maybe you're carrying the storyline of your parents or your heritage or your legacy or your lineage or whatever that is, and you need not to carry that anymore because it's not yours. You have been doing that service, but now it's time to put it down. And then maybe there's something you need to pick up, like you need to pick up your courage, or you need to pick up your voice, or you need to pick up your staunchness. No, that's not good enough. Or you need to pick up something in order to move forward into that next unfolding of your storyline. So that particular construct, that sentence stems, helps people to see their story from a more outside perspective. It's easier to look at your own story if you're not in it yourself. Mm. You know, if you can say she, I could say that was the princess. And so in the end of my story, the princess, of course, becomes the queen and does some healing of the kingdom, which is really helpful, but healing of myself too. And how do I claim the power that is mine to wield and the gifts that are mine to give, and have those flow out rather than being restricted? So in the end of my story, the castle, which was quite dim and darkly lit, got illuminated, the doors got thrown open, and the water started to flow. So the gifts could flow out. So that's a good question for anybody who's listening to this. You know, if you wrote your own personal fairy tale, what would that sound like, and what could you learn from it about yourself and your own storyline, and where your storyline is taking you to this moment, and what might be facing you in the future?
Yeah, and I guess it might be also quite fun to write it down. And then when you are in a different point in your life, you feel change, something is really different, do it again and then see what's the story then.
Yes. Yeah, I worked with a group in Belgium earlier in the year where we did that. They wrote the fairy tale of how their organization started. And then I said to them, because I wanted to send them on kind of an Arthurian quest, that they met up with Merlin, and Merlin gave them the parchment. and said where to go, and they shared that, and then they worked in small groups. So where does the storyline go from there? You've met the wizard at the crossroads. He shared the message. Where does the storyline now go? And that mythic construct took them to a whole different level of conversation than they would have come to if they just gone, let's talk about our strategic plan.
Yeah. Beautiful.
So our stories are the road we travel on. They are powering on what we can and cannot do, or the possibilities we see for ourselves. And it's really interesting to say it's important to work with those.
And for me, it also feels when I sense in from time to time, I really have this where I'm touched and where I have become goosebumps on my skin. And it's always when I sense also that when we talk about or when we use certain words, for me, it feels we invite different intelligence, different energies, different frequencies, however you want to call it. It's it feels as if our field in which we are and in which we are sharing and talking with each other, much more beings, much more intelligence or whatever is joining them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's like, for me, what story does, it creates the fireplace where we can meet, or the fire where we can meet around. And then obviously what happens is all those attending spirits come to, you know, the storytellers of the past, the great stories that have been, the net that we live in, like Indra's net, you know, it's a net that has little jewels at each corner, so it's magnified again and again and again. All of those things that we have experienced as humanity are invited to come too, because story does that.
Yeah.
It's an invitational field.
Yeah. Beautiful.
So as a story activist, I really look and say, okay, what are the steps you would need to take? Mm-hmm. How do you work on that stuff if you want to get really practical? So can I share my practices with you? So the first one is kind of makes sense. Be more curious. It's like, can you cultivate your curiosity? And that question you ask, who am I going to be today, is a really wonderful way to cultivate that. But also as things are happening, it's about how do I make more of a gap between my experience and my response? So I don't immediately get angry. Somebody's cut me off in traffic, but I say, oh, I'm really curious what might be happening for them that they're in such a rush. Could I change the story of they're being really rude to maybe there's an emergency in their house? And let me make some space for that. So how do I become more curious? How do I start asking questions? And learning how to ask questions is a good start to that one.
Yeah, or also giving me the freedom to react differently to circumstances, not just repeating my automatical habit, but giving me the freedom. Let's see, is there another way to...
Yeah. I had friends who, in their relationship, they had that concept called lavacious intent. So I don't know if you've heard of malicious intent. Malicious intent is the intention to do someone harm. But they said, let's have the belief that there is lavacious intent, that the intention behind stuff is for love.
Beautiful.
We're not doing it in a way that's maybe very helpful or feels very loving, but that really, if we think about it, then my partner is always here with lavacious intent. So if you already come in with that curiosity, I wonder what they really meant to have happen here rather than what happened, then that curiosity helps you to go to a new place rather than into a corner or into the usual argument. The second thing, we've talked about this already, which is be a good story listener. So really cultivating, if you want to be a good storyteller, if you want to learn more about stories, then listening is the key. So if you went out, for example, and gave yourself the assignment, today I'm really going to listen for stories in my world. I wonder where they are. And see what you can, be a story catcher. Christina Baldwin calls that story catching, and I love that. I think being a story catcher is an incredible gift. You learn a lot if you do that. And by the way, people think you're more intelligent if you listen to them. That's the interesting thing too. Automatically you get, yeah, you're deep and you listen. Amazing. And not many people are listening these days. So it's real difference.
Yeah, and the other thing is that it builds trust. It builds a quality also of where people feel safe and they're really willing to share. So it often happens to me that people I never met before, they tell me their deepest worries, their deepest challenges, and just because since my childhood, I just loved hearing what people have to tell and what they share. And for me, it's a privilege if people do so. So I guess they sense it. And
yeah, you can sense if someone else is open and curious and listening.
Yeah.
It's a real gift. So number three, start telling stories that will help us to live well together. So this is about activating the stories that really help. We have a lot of news media that's activating the negative stories, but are there things that could help? And I was thinking specifically about the Me Too movement. So this movement about power over and abuse that's happened. If we don't start telling some stories of how we would like men specifically to be, stories of behavior that we really appreciate, then in fact we've said, no, we don't want this, but then there's a void. So what are the stories of what we do want? And a lot of people know what they don't want, but they don't know what they do want. They can tell you really quickly what they don't want. But I often find myself in groups going, yeah, so what do you want? Can you state that as the positive affirmative so that it calls us to move in that direction? And stories that we talked before, pattern the space. The more kind of stories you hear about something, the more possibility there is for that happening. So we often go looking for evidence to prove that we're right. But what if we went looking for evidence to prove a possibility? That could be really, really interesting. Mm. So then there's this about building your capacity to create spaces where stories can be shared. So that for me is a big question, especially as we're looking at the refugee crisis, as we're looking at people being displaced. Where is that place where we can share our stories? Because the only way we're going to find our way together is to weave our stories together. So where is that place where we can meet? And I've asked this in a few different governmental places. Where is the place for us to share our stories? I don't want to make a submission to what the local government wants to do. I'd like to hear some stories about what's going on, so I can learn something. Because listening and being in conversation, listening to stories, means you're willing to learn something or to be in learning together. And it's important to create spaces where we can be in learning together. So Art of Hosting is one of those ways to learn some process work, just light structure around how can you invite people into conversations to share their stories. But how could all of us get more competent at making those spaces, whether it's around a dining table, in your living room, on the street, standing in line at the grocery store, at the market? Where is that place? I have a friend who's a storyteller who's like this story magnet. You know, he stands in the market and 15 people will be around him. It's amazing. He's a natural space for stories to be shared.
Yeah, and I had the image with the refugees. When I tuned in the situation, what I got was we should just invite each other and cook together and eat together and just share. That was the antidote of rejection and not knowing and fear.
It's hospitality.
Yeah.
And in fact, people from most of the cultures who have been refugees have amazing hospitality as part of their culture. That's what they do know how to do. They know how to share food, even if there's very little. So that would be an interesting thing to learn how to do in these current days, too. We could learn from each other.
Yeah.
And that's been a human practice, breaking bread together, they would call it in the Christian tradition, I suppose. It's a human practice to do that, and something we can easily do and invite each other into. So number five, I love this one. Ask yourself, what is mine to do?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be very tempting to want to take on every cause out there, but probably there's something in the world that has your particular name attached to it. There is a period-sized space in the universe that only you can fill. Mm-hmm. And being really attentive to what is mine to do truly. takes your gifts into action in a really important way. So those first five are all kind of focused on what are my skills. And the second five are about how do you do something together. So find your team, lean in, and stay connected. If you want to shift something bigger, it takes a field to shift a field. That's what we've learned from quantum physics. So two or three people are needed to make anything bigger happen. Just by yourself, you can, it's very hard to make something very big happen. But once you have two or three people, you have a magnetic attractor. You have possibility. So how do you get clear about your ways of working? How do you get clear about how you're going to handle conflict? How do you stay connected and stay together? Because it can be turbulent sometimes doing big stuff. It's like going on a rapid river where the you get in the rapids, you're kind of like, how do you stay in the boat? It's a good question to think about first before you get in the rapids. Take courage, focus on what matters, and start anywhere. So I've talked to a lot of people recently, and we've kind of agreed, this isn't the time for perfection. This isn't the time for, I have to know the answer before I start. Just start. And call it an experiment. Don't say this is the answer. Be in the not knowing. So this is, we talked about too, the not knowing is really important to embrace that. So just start somewhere, start and see what happens and keep going, keep working with that.
I like that a lot.
This one I like too. If it's about them, don't do it without them.
Yeah.
So how many conversations have we had about children where there were no children present, or about elderly and there are no elderly present, or about refugees and there are no refugees? Like, if it's about something, get those people in there. Get anybody in who's going to be impacted by what you're doing, because the only way to do it is together. So how do you invite people, make an invitation for somebody to be in a conversation with you about something you're interested in? Number 9, focus on the possible. Dream the impossible. So you might have a forest in your mind. Just start planting a tree, man. Just get up. Start with the first tree. Just keep going. With the first tree, start with the possible and keep the forest in your mind, and it will eventually arise. It may be in 50 years time, but I've read those stories and seen those stories of people who dreamed of a forest and just kept planting the trees. And even maybe after they were gone, it was still there. It was still there. Actually, I'm in Ohio right at the moment. There's in the United States, the story of Johnny Appleseed, who was a man who walked, he took the apple pulp and seeds out of the cider presses, and he used to walk with them and drop them along the way so that fruit trees would grow and people could eat as they were moving west. And there's some of those trees still here. So that dream of, I might only be able to do a small thing, but you can know how many seeds are in an apple, but you can't know how many apples are in the seed, right? So it's kind of interesting to look at it like that. Final one is, commit to being a learner and keep practicing. The moment you think, I know everything, it's the moment that the door closes. So the best thing you can do, as all martial arts practitioners know, is to keep practicing, and meditators. Keep practicing. There will be those days when you think, I've got this, I've got it. And those days when you go, oh my goodness, beginner's mind. But if we realize we're in learning and we can invite people to be in learning with us, it makes it easier. It's like doing the experiment all the time.
Yeah, and I mean, in the situation we are right now, we don't know. It's all about learning and entering and feel an area which is new. It's all about learning.
Yeah. So the best thing we can do is make invitations. Be curious, make invitations, because an invitation is so much more magnetic than a it has to be this way statement. Like, a question is so much more of a door opener than a statement. And an invitation is so much stronger than a have to. It's compelling. An invitation means I can bring myself. Just like if I'm invited to tell my story, it means I can bring myself. And then there's that one thing to think about. People often talk about, how do we make it safe to tell the stories that matter to us? And I've come to realize over time, it's not about safe, it's about safe enough. There's no way you can make something totally safe, but you can put something in place to make it safe enough. And that discomfort doesn't mean you're unsafe, it means you're in learning.
Yeah, and also I would say the really good and touching stories are where you are vulnerable, where you're not perfect, where there are challenges, difficulties. Those are really the touching stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I think of myself sometimes as I've been traveling around the world like a secret story catcher, like, you know, in the Western, Northwestern tradition, you carry a basket on your back and you put the firewood in. So I feel like I've been carrying this basket and putting stories in, and I have people still with me because of the stories I'm carrying of them. And I feel like I'm collecting or catching those stories because they are much needed at some other point in time. And I may not know until that moment when it is, but it's like I'm holding this little jewel ready for the moment when I need to give it away. And I think that's the gift we give to each other, is our sharing of stories. And stories live by being shared.
Mm. Yeah. Is there any particular story which maybe just recently touched you a lot, where you want to share it?
Oh my goodness, so many. Which ones? Or the question is whether it's an individual story or whether it's from kind of the folklore canon. But what was arising in my mind as I was saying that just before is a story that comes from Indonesia. And it's a story about a young boy who had an old servant. And every day the old servant would tell the boy a new story, every night a new story. But this young man didn't ever share the stories. So the stories were forced to live in a leather bag that was hanging on the back of the door. And eventually more and more stories were gathered, and eventually it became so cramped that the stories became angry and they decided to take revenge. So by this point in time in his life, the young man was promised to a young woman, and it was about the time that he and his whole procession would go to her village in order for him to be married. And so the stories decided, this is a great time to take revenge. So the first story hid itself in a patch of strawberries. And as they rode by on their horses, it was a hot day, and so everyone looked at this patch of strawberries and they thought to themselves, oh, wouldn't a strawberry be delicious? And the young man asked his servant to get him a strawberry. So the servant brought the strawberries. The old servant was nearby and was watching and noticed something very strange about these strawberries. And so just as the young man was about to reach into the bowl to take a strawberry, the servant dashed the strawberries away. Well, the young man thought that was very strange behavior, but he didn't say anything. They went further on, and this time there was a well, and everyone wanted a drink of cool water, but the second story was hiding in the well and had poisoned it. Once again, the servant dashed away the cup right before the young man could drink. Everybody was beginning to think, is this old man gone crazy? These things kept happening, and finally the wedding happened, and it was the wedding night, and the young man and the young woman were about to lay down to sleep together for the first time as husband and wife when a snake appeared in the room. It was the final story, deciding to get revenge. And right at that moment, the old man came in with a big sword and cut the head off the snake. And of course, said to the young man what the issue was. So after that time, the young man began to share all the stories that the old servant had given to him. And he began to share them and share them every day. And the stories were happy. And when I first heard that, I thought, you know, that says something to me about when people are holding stories they believe cannot be shared, how much that can poison the well. When the story is stuck, it can't be shared, it can't go anywhere, because when a story gets shared, it can move, it can transform. And we have that challenge with our own individual lives. We have it in our communities. We have it in our nations. We have it in our planetary system. These stories that somehow cannot be spoken, cannot be shared, are not recognized, that are beginning to be angry and stuck and wanting to take revenge. So where do we make the space? How do we make the space to share those stories that maybe are our most tender, most confronting, most challenging, or even where we feel fearful or guilty or ashamed? Where is that place we can share them so we can release that and move forward into the new story that we need for humanity, or the new stories we need for humanity? So that's why I find the role of the storyteller, the story catcher, to be really important and something every human can take on.
And Mary Alice, where would you say, we talked before that we are kind of, or everybody on its own is hitting a edge into the unknown. And how would you describe, what is your edge where you try to find out more about it, or where you see yourself kind of going there, going back and looking around? Which is the territory where you explore?
Well, the first one is in the whole story activism piece. What does that actually mean? How can you involve systems in changing the larger narrative? I was thinking that particularly as I was living in Europe, the diversity of Europe from east to west, from north to south is amazing. The fact that it exists currently in the shape it does is because of the European story. But how do you look at those storylines and figure out where they morph and how they fit and what could transform them into a better whole? So that's my kind of exploration and story. I also have been really intrigued by the concept of eldership and stewardship and what those mean. Like, I think we're at the point where we've made our elders into elderlies, and we're telling them they should step aside and, you know, go into rest homes and things like that. But how do we retrieve the gifts of eldership? And I don't think eldership actually has all that much to do with age. You know, I think you can have young people who are elders and what they know, but how do we make the space for that honoring of eldership? And the concept of stewardship is, how do we move away from ownership, I own this, it's mine, to stewardship, I serve this, which is a natural, it on one level, it owns me, you know, like, this is mine to do. I am stewarding. And stewarding doesn't have to be a huge plot of land. It could be a musical score or a child or a dance move or a rap poem. Or what are you stewarding? The idea that freedom could be something else, you know, like, okay. And then I think the final thing I'm really intrigued about is feminine power, and how do we actually embrace that regardless of sex? It's not a gender thing, but rather a turning back to the planet, to stewarding, to caring, to nurturing, and to holding each other. So what does it mean to be a humanity together? Just a few small things before dinner.
Yeah, there it came to my mind. I guess that men and women tell different stories, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. And often those stories that have been collected, and Campbell knew this, Joseph Campbell, when he was working on the hero's journey, that most of the stories that could be collected were men's stories, that the women's stories were not collected. He had to turn to fairy tales to try to find some of those. And I still think those stories are under the radar or not given the attention that they deserve for how we hold the world together. Mm-hmm. And maybe possibly underneath all of this is the biggest question of all, which is how do we be the fullest embodiment of our souls on this human journey? What's that story look like? How do we tell it?
Yeah, and what I get a lot in what you share is that it is a flow, it's a journey, it's ongoing changing. It's not something you have it, then it's dead. It's not static.
No. Yeah. And our stories are there's snippets of an onflowing river which enable us to understand a moment in time. That's what they can do. They're not all of it. They're a snapshot of the journey, really, for that moment.
Beautiful. Wow, it's so rich what you bring, what you've already collected.
Thank you for letting me bring that here. I'm really, really pleased to have had this invitation.
Yeah. I hope that many people get inspired and just are opening their doors and their windows and expanding and getting curious.
Me too. It would be, let's be awake together.
Yes. Is there anything else, Mary Ellis, what I haven't asked you, because you said, it's about questions, and something you say, I would like to share it.
I don't know, but I'm looking at two things on my wall here. I have, you know, that it's said that Queen Elizabeth has that statement, keep calm and carry on. But what I have on my wall says, keep calm and story on. But the other thing I have here, which is something I went to a 5-day or co-hosted a 5-day gathering on race, power, and equity. And we were asked to write ourselves a postcard. So this got mailed to me. And I just saw it there in my view, and it was a reminder of what I said to myself at the beginning of June, but maybe it bears repeating. It is both my responsibility and challenge to stay awake, to create awareness of old stories and new possibilities, to model the change I want to see, and to create stamina, resilience, and love enough to keep calling myself and others in.
Lovely. I just want to let it sink. And what did you find out? What supports you in being awake?
I think the first thing that I need to do, and I can tell others are helped by, is cultivating presence. How do I stay present? How do I stay grounded? And the reasons I have these words stamina and resilience in this statement are because, in fact, to hear others' stories, to listen deeply, requires stamina. You need to have enough energy. You need to be well enough or fit enough or have enough vitality to stay with it. And the resilience part is when you're working with other people's emotions, you need resilience. You need emotional resilience to be able to do that. And most likely, instead of empathy, you actually need compassion. I was listening to research recently that was talking about if you fall into empathy so much, eventually you burn out because you feel all the stuff that other people are feeling. Whereas if you can stay in compassion, you don't burn out. You can send the love that direction, but you don't have to wear all the things that you're experiencing or that you're seeing with other people. Mm-hmm. And love for me at this point in time in the planet is not a fluffy pink thing. It's fierce. You know, it takes fierceness to love in spite of what is going on, to love because of what is going on, and to love whatever is going on. All of that is a fierce quality. So all of those things together are quite interesting, and that's why I think it's a responsibility and a challenge at the same time. It's sword practice for the world as it is now. So it's a warrior of the heart practice, really, to stay awake and present enough in this day and day-to-day life now to be helpful. Or not even to be helpful, even to be present. Maybe it's not about helping at all. Because witnessing somebody else is the greatest gift you can give them. You don't need to fix something, but to be witnessed, to be truly seen, wow. That's an act of fierce love.
Yeah, and then in a way, what I also get when I really can take situations, words, stories in, but not carrying it, like you explained it, but really kind of resonate with it. And then from listening and from being present, listening, taking time, And in what are, what inspires me, and what you said, what is my, what is Puriya's action? Just coming from hearing that, it can be something very simple, very natural, doesn't need to be a big thing.
Yeah.
For me, it has a lot to do. For me, presence is needs really space. It needs not always a totally full schedule, not always on the computer, on the smartphone. It needs gaps. It needs space. It needs kind of also that we invite it, that we value it.
Yeah. It needs breath.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of our biggest human gifts that we often never think about until we can't do it. You know, like if you have a cold, then suddenly you get very appreciative of breath. But the breath is the guide, really. You know, if you can breathe all the way down, you're not going to panic. And that breath is a vitalizing thing. It's what we share. And that's why in the Māori tradition, when you greet someone else, you press noses together because it's mingling the breath of life. Mm-hmm. So it's an undervalued way to help us stay present.
Yeah, and also what I get is this rhythm, you know, coming and going and coming and going, being active, being passive, giving and receiving, all of that.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful, Mary Alice. I enjoyed our dialogue very much. I hope people listening and watching that as well. And I mean, is there anything you want to share, upcoming programs? I mean, I will share this interview at the end of October, beginning November. I don't know if you have anything planned.
Well, the Story of the Future Summit will have taken place in September, which when we've recorded this interview earlier than that. But the material is still accessible. If you go to storyofthefuture.com, you can see how to become part of that tribe. If you're interested in being part of the conversation around story, we'd love to have you there.
Beautiful. And we will share all the links and everything. So thank you very much, Mary Ellen.
Thank you too.
Contributing to the Conscious Evolution Summit.
Thank you.